The country of Chile is famous for what must be the world's longest and skinniest country all along the west coast of South America. Yet sandwiched between its high peaks of the Andes and the Pacific coast, 40,000 square miles of northern Chile hosts one of the most extreme environments on Earth. The Atacama Desert is one of the driest places on the planet. NASA uses it to test equipment for Mars. But the otherworldly landscape is also teeming with a surprising mix of life. And beneath its briny salt flats are some of the world's largest stores of lithium, that coveted mineral needed for modern electronics and green energy. U.S.-born travel writer Mark Johansson explores this fascinating region in his book, Mars on Earth. It chronicles his wanderings in the Atacama during a time of personal and political turmoil, as he sought whatever insights the desert might offer into his own life and into his adopted country. He joins us now from his home in Santiago. Mark, thanks for being with us on Travel with Rick Steves.
Oh, thanks, Rick, for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you live in Santiago, the capital city of Chile, right?
That's right, yeah.
And where is that relative to this desert we're talking about, Atacama?
So Santiago is just right in the middle of Chile, and the desert is roughly about a third of Chile, and it's all in the north. So just north of Santiago, about 6 hours, begins the desert.
So you fly into Santiago and then just head north and you find yourself in the driest place on Earth.
Something like that. I mean, a lot of people will fly to get really into the heart of the desert, but you can drive or take a bus. Just depends on what kind of traveler you are.
All right. So the book's called Mars on Earth. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So Mars on Earth has to do a lot with the way NASA has historically looked at this region. So NASA uses the Atacama as an analog for Mars. So when they want to test those instruments that we send up to Mars, you know, they need to be perfect before they go up in orbit. And what NASA has found is that the Atacama is the closest place we have here on Earth to what the land is like up on Mars.
Wow. So now, I mean, it's famously dry, but just how dry is it? I mean, some weather stations there in the desert have never even recorded precipitation.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a legend. That's what everyone says about the desert. There are parts of the desert that do get rain. There are parts that get rain every year. It really depends on the different areas that you're in. But there's a specific area called Yungay, which is where NASA goes when they want to test their instruments for Mars. And they use it because, you know, when you're going up to Mars, you're searching for life, right? That's our mission up there. And so what better place than somewhere that has the least life that you can find on planet Earth?
Now, when you talk about life in a desert that is almost totally dry, there is water. I mean, there's this coastal fog that locals can actually collect, right, to get a little water. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's the Camanchaca, which is a coastal fog. So this is a coastal desert, I guess, first would be an important thing to say. And because of that, you get a lot of these clouds that come in from the Pacific. And they bring a bit of moisture with them, but they don't actually drop down as rain.
Okay, so they're cheating a little bit. It's on the coast, so you get a little spillover from the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, anywhere close to an ocean, I think around the world is going to have a bit of humidity. And so you do get these clouds that come in on the coast, kind of like in a place like San Francisco. And you also, because of the Andes, because they're so tall, you do get a bit of snow melt that comes down in rivers. So there are these little pockets of life, these little oases scattered throughout the Atacama.
So who lives there?
Surprisingly, more people than you would think. There's over 1 million people that live in the Atacama Desert. And because of that
over
moisture...
Over 1 million people. It must just be like cheap real estate.
Well, they need to have workers for the mines. You know, this is a very mineral...
Okay, so it's not like indigenous people that have always lived there.
Also, there's that also? Too. So more so up in the Altiplano, as well along the coast. Most of the coastal cities would be people who have moved up there from somewhere else to work in the mining industry or to support the mining industry in other ways. When you get up to the Altiplano, which is the second largest high plateau on Earth after Tibet, that's where you find a lot of these indigenous communities.
Is there a heritage of indigenous people being nomadic, like in other deserts, where they will move from place to place, or do they settle down in ravines and oases?
Yeah, so historically, you have like the Capac Nan, the greater Inca road that starts in Cusco and comes all the way down through Chile and Argentina, as well as up to Ecuador and Colombia. And along those routes, you would have these vast llama caravans that people would trade goods on. So it does have all of these signs of life. You have these huge geoglyphs and wild rock art all throughout the desert that speak to its long history of human inhabitants.
Yeah. So when you go there and you have this interesting sort of attraction to it, what does it feel like? I mean, do you make a point to be in a desolate spot? And then what's it like to be there?
Yeah, it's a good question. This journey made me realize the joy I get out of uncomfortable places. I think a lot of us as travelers, you know, we're automatically attracted to the most comfortable, easiest places that you can find on Earth. And I think sometimes we ought to give the more uncomfortable places a second look because they force us to really look inside of ourselves and feel these really deep, big emotions that we lose when we just travel and plop ourselves down on a beach, for example.
So you're basically a Chilean. You've adopted this country. You've lived there for more than a decade. As a tourist, if I was to come in, I mean, there's activities, stargazing, trekking, and so on. How does a tourist approach the Atacama Desert? What do you do to have an experience?
Yeah, most visitors, if they're coming to the Atacama, they'll end up in San Pedro de Atacama. It's the biggest sort of resort town in San Pedro with a great tourist infrastructure, lots of nice hotels and restaurants. And from there, you can go out and explore volcanoes, and you can go and explore big lagoons filled with flamingos and go on all sorts of different outdoor adventure-y kind of activities from there. If you're into stargazing, you would probably go down to the Elqui Valley, which is in the southern part, technically just outside of the Atacama Desert. But there you have huge astronomy facilities. I mean, 2/3 of the world's astronomy facilities are in the Atacama Desert, and a lot of them are near the Elqui Valley. So you can go, you know, rub shoulders with the scientists during the day and see what they're doing, and then come back at night to look through telescopes at some of the clearest skies you'll find anywhere on Earth.
2/3 of the global infrastructure for astronomy. This is amazing. This must be the ultimate experience for anybody who's a stargazer.
It is. It's the ultimate. And it's not just that you're learning about the scientific perspective of the skies, because one of the interesting things about the Atacama as well is that the indigenous communities who've lived there for millennia have their own way of looking at the stars. So you could go one night and look at the stars from a scientific perspective, and then come back another night and look at the stars from an indigenous perspective, which is totally different because many of the indigenous communities are actually looking for the dark spots in the sky.
Looking for the dark spots. Do they have any kind of herb that they chew on or smoke to make that even darker?
Well, there's definitely a lot of chewing on coca leaves in the Atacama, that's for sure.
Chewing on coca leaves. Tell me more.
Well, coca leaves are the base ingredient famously for cocaine, and it's the ingredient that used to be found in Coca-Cola. Now it's really a sacred herb, not just in the Atacama, but all over Andean South America. So it's an herb that you'll find sort of chewed up and wadded and tossed onto rocks to ask for safe passage in areas. People use it to fight the altitude because much of the Atacama Desert is above 13,000 feet. So it's used for all sorts of different things.
Medicinal.
Medicinal, yes, correct.
Mark Johansson is an American journalist who's been based in Santiago, Chile since 2014. He's taking us along right now on Travel with Rick Steves on his 1,200-mile odyssey through one of the driest places on Earth, the Atacama Desert. He writes about it in his first literary work. It's called Mars on Earth. It was released in 2024 by Rocky Mountain Books. Mark has also co-authored about 20 Lonely Planet guidebooks to the Americas and Asia and contributed to a dozen of their coffee table books. His website is markjohansson.com. So, Mark, we've got the tourists coming there and stargazing and sometimes getting a little more vivid look at the sky, thanks to local herbs or whatever. But it's a serious industrial economy and so on because of the minerals there. I mean, you were talking about lithium, for example, which is a really important mineral in the future and makes this pretty important bit of real estate. Tell me about the value from a mining point of view of this Atacama Desert.
Yeah, so one of the reasons that I wanted to travel through the Atacama is that it really is what generates the economy for Chile. So Chile is a very much a mineral-based economy. Previously, copper would be the main mineral that people were looking for. Nowadays, it's lithium. So you have companies and, you know, all sorts of nations just planting their flags all across the Atacama at this moment, because lithium is the main ingredient in a lithium ion battery. So that's, you know, what we need to fuel our transition from gas-powered cars to electric ones. So everyone is in search of lithium. But what we don't think about a lot, I think, in the US or Europe or wherever you may be based, is where that mineral comes from and what effect that's having on the communities that are living right next to it. And that's sort of the debate and the conversation that I wanted to have with certain parts of this book.
And the recognition of the mineral wealth in the desert is nothing new. I mean, you wrote about three countries were fighting a war over this back in the 1880s.
Absolutely. So the War of the Pacific is a big war that a lot of people in the U.S. have never heard of, but it really shaped parts of South America. So Chile was fighting against Bolivia and Peru and won that war with a lot of help from the U.K., who was interested in the mining in the Atacama. And so because of that, Chile took over a vast part of what is now the Atacama Desert that used to belong to Bolivia and Peru. And that land has made Chile one of the richest countries in South America. So it's a story that really shaped the future of this country.
Mark, when you say one of the richest countries in South America, does that mean it's one of the richest and best off societies, or is it all taken up by a corrupt gap between rich and poor?
Because exactly.
There's this notion of the curse of natural resources, where a country can be rich in natural resources, Nigeria and oil, for example, and actually it makes their people more miserable. How does that work in Chile?
No, I think you're spot on with that. I mean, Chile is also one of the most divided countries in the OECD, which is this grouping of, you know, middle to high income countries, because the wealthy few in Chile have a vast majority run the economy. There's sort of a saying in Chile, like if you have a winery with your name on it, you're one of these families that run the country. So it is a very unequal society. And that's part of what set me off on this journey in the first place, because Chile went through a massive social uprising in 2019, where people were just fed up with the inequality in the country and were trying to rewrite the constitution to make Chile a more fair and equal place.
You know, the United States is dealing with that right now. We've got this discussion. I mean, a couple of years ago, nobody knew what the word oligarchy meant. And now it's something that is confronting us as we realize the fragility of our democracy and how, you know, the courts have decided that people with a lot of money, that's part of their free speech, that their money can talk. And I think with a bigger gap between rich and poor in Chile.
I would say so, yeah, for sure.
What can we learn when the United States, a lot of people aren't really concerned if a few rich people have more than their share because dollars talk. Well, dollars talk in Chile, is that good for the fabric of their democracy and good for the people, or is there a trickle down? I mean, what can we learn?
No, I mean, absolutely. That is exactly what led to this huge social uprising. I mean, it was something that was just boiling under the surface for years and years and years, and there was little protest movements here and there, but then all of a sudden just exploded in October of 2019 and really is still a topic of dialogue here. You know, what can the outcomes of that big protest and riot movement be to change the country, which to this day hasn't really changed much?
What's the makeup of the teams? Is it the industrial elites that are combining with the political elites that are able to work together to keep the masses down?
Yeah, I would say certainly. And working together with certain religious organizations as well to shape cultural not changing anything in the culture.
Ah, okay. So that is taking these economic interests and pairing them with social wedge issues, and that gives them a critical mass.
Yeah, so Chile has tried twice now, because of this big social uprising, has tried twice now to change its constitution, but you can pick one issue. The first constitution that we voted for was too progressive for many because it gave lots of rights to indigenous communities. It gave gender parity in the government. It gave lots of rights to land, and it poked on some religious issues, abortion, among other things, that if any of those issues were things that you were against, you could vote against it. So 80% of the population wanted a new constitution, and then nearly just as many voted against the constitution that they were given. So it's been kind of a...
it's kind of a mess. I guess what I was getting at, I just wonder how comfortable can an American be flying into Santiago and being a tourist up in the desert.
Well, what I would say to that is that being a tourist in Chile, just as anywhere in the world, is one, you're contributing oftentimes to rural communities. You know, tourists are the ones who go out to these small towns where the people do not have much economic power. And so if tourists are not coming to visit these smaller towns, then those people are losing out on their chance to reach the middle class. So I think that tourism is actually a great way, and that tourists are very much welcome to come to all the countries of this part of the world.
Especially if their money goes to real local people.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that there is so much negative news that comes out of this part of the world that coming here really helps change your perspective, because you don't come here and you don't think about crime or the way the government's not working. What you see is, you know, interesting people, amazing food, landscapes that will blow your mind. And that's what you take home with you. It's not the government's a mess, yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with travel writer Mark Johansson, and he's joining us now from Santiago in Chile. And his book is Mars on Earth, Wandering the World's Driest Desert. Mark also writes about travel, food, design, and sustainability. You'll see his work in National Geographic, Travel and Leisure, The Economist, Condé Nast, and he's a co-author of Lonely Planet Guides. To learn more about Mark's work, you can see the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Mark, you wrote in your book that you were searching as you wandered the Atacama during a time of personal and political turmoil. You were seeking insight into yourself, into your adopted country, and into its place in the world. It's interesting that you wrote a chapter in the book called Message from Above, an oasis for outcasts, a place where New Age hippies would go to seek. And you went there to seek. You know, tell us about that dimension of the desert. Did it deliver for you? What was going on in your life, and what did the desert do?
Sure. You know, I think if you look at deserts all around the world, they're a landscape that tends to attract outcasts and outsiders. They open your mind up to big thinking. If you think about UFO sightings, why do they always happen in desert environments? And I think it has to do with this palpable connection you have in a desert between the earth and the sky, because it's just such a massive sky. You're looking up into
that's
the sky.
That's it. Yeah. A palpable connection between the earth and sky. That's why there's all the telescopes there.
Exactly,
Well, maybe you're not physically closer, but you can see it better.
You are kind of physically closer, though, because in a lot of places of the Atacama, you're up on the Altiplano.
Oh, there you go.
So you're above 13,000 feet. That's why a lot of these astronomy facilities are there, because the ultraviolet radiation is massive. The sky is just with this full sun that's a spotlight on you all day. And it can make you a little crazy, but sometimes that's fun to get yourself out of your comfort zone.
That's travel.
That's travel, exactly. That's the fun of travel for me.
A lot of time you can learn more about your home by leaving it and looking at it from a distance.
Oh, absolutely.
And if that distance may be from the driest place on Earth where the stars are the brightest, that may
exactly.
be a source of enlightenment. Wow. Mark Johansson, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for writing a fascinating book, Mars on Earth. Maybe someday I'll see you wandering, a crazed lunatic in the desert as the stars are twinkling and there's a big smile
on
your
face.
Come
save me if you find me wandering the desert, please.
I won't save you. I'll have you let me join you.
Okay, sounds like a plan.
All right. Hey, happy travels.
Thank you. You as well. Cada día es absurdo, como un pozo al caer. Cada día me río, para no despreciar.
Mark posts articles that he's written about people and destinations in South America, from Patagonia to Easter Island to the Andes of Ecuador. It's on his website, markjohansson.com. His book about the Atacama Desert is called Mars on Earth. Next, we'll open the phone lines and check listener emails to us to hear how your travels have been going. We're at 877-333-7425. And radio at ricksteves.com is how you reach us by email, right here at Travel with Rick Steves.